Welcome to the Campbell Conversations. I'm Grant Reher. We're starting into football season, and my guest today is the sports journalist and writer, Armin Katayan. His career is too long and too storied for me to try to summarize here, but he's worked for NBC, ABC, CBS, and HBO Sports, and is the author of 13 books, including several bestsellers. He's here with me today to talk about his newest book, The Price: What It Takes to Win in College Football's Era of Chaos, which he wrote with John Talty. Mr. Katayan, welcome to the program.
Thanks, Grant. Nice to be here.
Well, it's great to have you here. So a lot of your book is about the effects of NIL and the transfer portal on college football. And just if we could start briefly for our listeners who aren't followers of college football, just tell us briefly how NIL works and what the transfer portal is.
Yes, NIL is short for name, image, and likeness. And so if someone was looking at me right now and all of a sudden my picture came up in a movie or on a video game, but it didn't have my name associated with it, you'd look at it and go, well, that looks like Armin Katayan, his image and his likeness. And what had been a battle royale for decades between the student athletes who were largely responsible for creating the revenue that the NCAA was enjoying had never been compensated a single cent for the use in perpetuity of their name, image, and likeness, particularly on video games, EA Sports, Electronic Sports video games, Electronic Arts video games. And so that's really, it's basically the ability to control your own image and to profit from the use of your image, whether it's in the commercialization of it, in sponsorships, on television, or in a video game. And then the transfer portal is basically like the ability to move freely from one program to another without having to sit out a year. In prior years, the NCAA had an eligibility requirement that said if you transfer from one school to another, you are obligated to sit out for a year before you would be eligible to play. And that was put in place to keep basically college sports becoming a form of free agency. Mm-hmm. And then what happened was through the courts and through litigation, that floodgate was opened. So now there are two what are called transfer portal windows, one that comes in the spring and one that comes in December. And during that period of time, there's a 30-day, currently a 30-day, soon to be narrowed to 15 days, where you can basically tell your coach, coach, I'm going to go out into the world, into the free agent world, and see if I can start at another program or, given the NIL money, whether I can get a better deal out there. Right. And so what that has done has just thrown both of those in combination, has thrown college football particularly into a form of chaos right now, because coaches don't know from one month to the next sometimes whether the team that they're currently working with and practicing with on the field is actually going to be the team that they'll have going into the next season.
Mm. What are some of the other effects that it's having on the sport?
Well, it's widespread. If you look at NIL, just the ability of players now to go into the open market, a lot of them have agents. A lot of these agents are not certified. They're not necessarily qualified to go into this world. And it has its own set of problems. Some of these kids who are signing are 18 years old and don't have lawyers or advisors with them, are signing contracts that allow the person, the agent involved, or the entity involved, it could be a collective, to have control of their name, image, and likeness in perpetuity, meaning forever. And that's not good, and that's dangerous. So number one, there's that. Number two is the NCAA is trying to determine and has put up certain guardrails that says you may not use NIL money as an inducement to have a player recruit or somebody in the portal sign with your program. Well, good luck trying to determine whether it's an inducement or not, because the process is so opaque right now. There are no national rules that say that, oh, you have to identify or put out into the open how much money you're getting, how long the deal is, what it is, what you have to do in order to get that money. So a lot of these NIL agreements come with NDAs, so they're non-disclosure. So the NCAA, that's a problem. And the portal, other problems with the portal is you combine NIL money, and whether you're getting recruited based on NIL money or you're transferring based on NIL money, you go into a locker room oftentimes, and this has happened many different times in different programs, where the starters are getting A. Well, A may be one half of what the new recruit B is getting to come in and has never played a single down in the history of that program. So the culture and the chemistry within that locker room has been thrown into absolute turmoil. So if you're a head coach, your problems usually were things that, oh, there's a drunk driving, or there's a drug car, or somebody's girlfriend got pregnant. This opens up a whole new, brave new world of issues that the coaches are having to deal with.
Yeah, well, there's so many things that to get into. Let me jump into a couple of them here. First one is the idea of student athletes getting an education may be becoming antiquated here. But I think my understanding is that the football coaches, you talked about the coaches a couple of times, they still hold on to this notion that they're helping to shape and develop these young men. And I think it was Nick Saban that said the NIL made him think about retiring. That was the reason, because the players only care about how much they're getting paid, exactly what you just said. So, I mean, how is it changing the life of the coaches' staff in terms of what they think they're doing in the world?
Well, if you go back to the issue of, and in the phrase student athlete, it's actually interesting because it was created by a man named Walter Byers, who was the most prominent NCAA president back into the 50s. He got the job at 29 years old and held on to it for 36 years. And he ran the NCAA, the National Collegiate Athletic Association, like a third world despot for about 36 years. And it was Byers who created the term student athlete, created it for the single reason of protecting the association against potential workers' compensation claims. Had an athlete been killed or seriously injured on the field, there were cases, workers' compensation cases, that were brought against the association, and they were turned down by the courts because of this student athlete phrase. And then they threw in the word amateurism, and then that became another catchword. Well, as time went on, you really had to flip the phrase. It became athlete-student. Athletes were spending far more time working out on the field, training, playing games, and traveling than they were in the classroom. And I know from the reporting I've done previously, I remember asking one Division I quarterback in the Pac-12, how many weeks a year are you working? Are you working for the football team? And I said, how many weeks off do you get a year? He put up his hand. It was 5 weeks off. So I'm not great at math, but that's 47 weeks a year that he's deeply involved in a football team. So that whole idea of student athlete now has become kind of an oxymoronic phrase in a lot of ways. And as more money has poured into the sport, you know, the coaches, there's a reason the book is called The Price, because it's not just about the financial windfall that has fallen upon these schools, in some cases north of $60 million a year in what are called grant of rights money per school. But it's the emotional and the physical and the psychological toll that's being taken on these coaches as they deal with all these whirlwinds of NIL, the portal, realignment, collectives, boosters. You know, what is going to happen the next day? And you're absolutely right, Grant. The one thing with Nick Saban was he wanted control over his program, absolute control. And he was losing control because of NIL and the portal. And I know after they lost to Michigan in the college football playoffs last year in the Rose Bowl, Nick went to his house in Florida, took a few days off, came back, and he had a lineup of kids outside his office. In normal years, they would be there, Coach Saban, what can I do to get better? What can I do to develop? What can I do to get on the field more next year? Not this time. Every single one of them, Nick said, was talking about money. And coach, I need more NIL money or I'm going to transfer. And that's when his wife, Miss Terry, who I know very well, said to Nick, what in the world are we doing here? This is not what we signed up for. And that's why Nick retired.
You're listening to the Campbell Conversations on WRVO Public Media. I'm Grant Reher, and I'm speaking with sports journalist Armin Katayan. With his co-author, John Talty, he's recently published The Price, What It Takes to Win in College Football's Era of Chaos. So you brought up player A getting twice the amount of money that player B is getting from the NIL. And, you know, that's immediately what it brings up in my mind is the inequities that are going to exist among the players, the same kind that we see in the pros. And so you have, you know, a few stars getting huge sums of money for playing what is ultimately a distinctly team sport. So do you think now that more teams are going to start to unionize to deal with this? Like, I believe Dartmouth's basketball team did that.
Well, I think what coaches are trying to do now is make it a democratic kind of a process. There's a certain thing called level set. They're trying to level set their program. Let's say you have and I'm just throwing this number out, $1.5 million NIL budget, and you have 100 players on your team. Well, everybody gets a level set. If you're a scholarship player, you're one of the 85 scholarship players, you will get $25,000 for that year. Spread out over 10 months. So $2,500 a month. If you're a walk-on, you know, you're not under scholarship, you get $12,500. Now, if you're a star and you're making an impact on the field, there are going to be, democratically, there will be more opportunities for you to make more money through the NIL collective. So you may be the one that where they say the car dealer calls up and says, hey, I need a star to come over and sign autographs for 2 hours, and I'm willing to give $10,000 to the collective, and the star makes $7,500 or $10,000 for his 2 hours worth of work. And that's become more of the norm now, because coaches realize if you bring in a player at $1 million, it doesn't take very long in a locker room for people to find out that that guy's making $1 million. And that has a tendency to throw the locker room into upheaval. Now, if the kid is great and he's helping you win, well, that's a different story. But if he's struggling, then the mumbling begins and the grumbling begins. And I think that's what the coaches have never had to deal with before. They've heard mumbling and grumbling from players because, you know, they haven't maybe gotten the opportunities they think they deserve, but they couldn't go into the portal immediately and leave the team. They were obligated to be there for a certain period of time. So, Grant, that's what they're dealing with. And I know for a fact that there have been, if you're a high school senior and you're a top recruit, a top quarterback in the country, and we chronicle Julian Sayen, who's from Carlsbad, California, in our book, and Julian took a huge discount to go to Alabama because he wanted to be coached by Nick Saban. Well, we know how that ended up. Julian's now at Ohio State. But the numbers for Julian in the open market for Power 5 teams, now Power 4 teams, were $8 million over 4 years. $2 million a year for an 18-year-old kid to come to play college football. So that gives you an idea of what the market is like. And if a team needs a great edge rusher or needs a great cornerback and you're in the right situation, it could be $500,000 for you for 1 year. So imagine putting that kind of money into the hands of an 18-year-old, oftentimes in a family that's coming from a situation where it's not been the best to that point. And so there are a lot of other sort of collateral damage and concerns that come along with this kind of brave new world that we're in right now.
You're listening to the Campbell Conversations on WRVO Public Media. I'm Grant Reher, and I'm talking with Armin Katayan, the sports journalist. He's recently co-authored a book with John Talty titled The Price, What It Takes to Win in College Football's Era of Chaos. And we've been discussing his book. So there's another kind of inequity that I'm thinking about here, which is whether the inequity between school programs will now become more exaggerated. And I'm thinking in particular of Syracuse, obviously, as where I am. There's There's been talk of forming some kind of super league of the top teams, and you write about the demise of the Pac-12 conference, for example. What is all this going to do to schools who, like Syracuse, currently have serious football programs, but they're not at that ultra elite level? Are they just going to keep fading down and down? And I think
it's a really difficult situation that schools like Syracuse find themselves in, because if there is a breakaway group, and you will see it largely from the Southeastern Conference, the SEC and the Big Ten, and they'll take a smattering of schools from the ACC, and they'll take a smattering from the Big 12. Let's say there's 64. I don't see how a school like Syracuse makes it. I don't see how Wake Forest makes it. I don't see how Pitt makes it. I don't see how Indiana, Illinois, or Purdue or Northwestern make it. And I don't know what's going to happen to those schools. I don't know whether there'll be another league that'll be formed, or they'll suddenly Syracuse will be playing more regional kind of football games. They would be playing more East Coast teams rather than travel. And you mentioned, Grant, the other thing is the impact of this is going to go across the board. A school like Michigan, which has the biggest brand, has the big house, 100+ thousand seats in that stadium, has Big Ten media rights money. Okay, they're gonna be great. They're gonna survive. But what about a Central Michigan that's in the Mid-American Conference? Well, there's a school that plays two non-conference games a year, basically to become the sacrificial lambs to play the Michigans on the road, or let's say they play Notre Dame on the road, and they get paid somewhere between $1.5 million and $2 million to go down and basically get beat up for a Saturday. Well, I know for a fact right now, with the consolidation of the Big Ten and there's more schools, those Central Michigan is losing one of those, what they call guarantee games. Well, it's $1.5 million out of their football budget. It's, somebody told me today, those two games, those $2.5 million games, $3 million, represented 1/3 of Central Michigan's $9 million football budget.
Wow.
Well, that the loss of that money is going to be very difficult, and it's going to have a trickle-down effect on the non-revenue sports. So the track and field at Central Michigan, the track and field, I can just point to Syracuse. What happens to the volleyball team? What happens to the lacrosse team? Great lacrosse program there, probably survives. But what happens to a women's softball team? What happens to the baseball team? I think that, as we look into the crystal ball, that's pretty fuzzy right now. But I think it's a pretty bleak picture overall for those non-rev sports. And that's going to be the collateral damage that comes as more and more of these schools are desperate to make it into that, whatever that final number is, 32, 48, 64. What happens underneath that remains to be seen, but I don't think it's going to be a very pretty picture at all.
Would it have been any better just to have these players allowed to be paid? Straight out salary,
No question. I think the NCAA's history is one of delay and denial. They've spent tens of millions of dollars defending themselves in court cases where athletes have gone before the courts and said, you know what, we're employees of the school. And the NCAA is essentially a cartel that's in violation of the Sherman Antitrust Act by artificially suppressing our wages. If I'm a music person and I happen to be a great violinist and I can go play with a Syracuse orchestra and I can get paid to do that, why, if I'm an athlete who's generating, in the case of an Alabama, over $100 million in revenue for this school, why can't I get paid? And the NCAA has always fallen back on this fallacy of, well, they're amateur athletes, we don't want to be professional, they're student athletes, blah, blah, blah. Well, the courts have clearly said, including the Supreme Court in July of 2021, you're a cartel. And you've been artificially suppressing wages, and you're in violation of the Sherman Act. And that threw the doors open for NIL. So I guess the point would be, had they decided to share the riches a couple of decades ago, when the opportunities were there, we wouldn't be facing this draconian situation that we're facing right now where nobody, frankly, has an idea what the next turn is going to be, where the solutions are really going to come from.
If you've just joined us, you're listening to the Campbell Conversations on WRVO Public Media. And my guest is the sports journalist, Armin Katayan. So another thing that's on my mind is, how is this going to change high school football? I imagine it's got to have a profound effect on this, because as you've laid out, you've got these kids going essentially directly from high school into the pros. I mean, the top stars. Is high school starting to look like college football? I mean,
I think high school football now has a different problem. High school football, because there wasn't this free agency where, let's say, Arizona needs to fill a void on its offensive line. In the past, they would have gone out and recruited a three or four or five star athlete to come into Tucson. They could develop that athlete. And then generally, hopefully by their sophomore or junior year, they're starting. There would be a commitment from the student athlete and there would be a commitment from the school. Well, now the pressure to win is so great. Arizona doesn't go to the high school level. It goes into the portal and it finds 60 offensive linemen, let's say right guards. They'll find 5, 10, 15 right guards in the portal on the NCAA website. And then they have other companies that work to give them more information. And then they'll reach out to that player and say, look, we're interested in you. So the effect of that is there are not as many high school athletes getting scholarship offers. The opportunities to go to college that they've had in the past, or at least not at the Power 5, Pro Power 4 programs now, SEC, Big 10, Big 12, and ACC, they might get an offer from San Diego State, but they're not going to get an offer from Oklahoma State, you know, or Texas A&M. And I think that's what's really affecting high school sports right now. High school sports is big business. High school sports is, you know, there's a game of the week. There's many games of the week that are televised, but the trickle down effect is significant right now at that level.
We've got about 4 minutes left or so. I want to try to squeeze in a couple more questions if I can.
Okay.
But you tell a lot of different stories in your book. What is the one individual story that you think is the most tragic in all of this?
Well, there's a few of those. I'll tell you the one that probably is closest to me because I did the reporting on it. And I go back to Julian Sayin, the quarterback from Carlsbad, California, the top recruit in the country as a quarterback in 2024. The only he could have gone to, and he was considered a savior at certain schools, Notre Dame, Penn State, Texas was after him, LSU was after him. The only school he made an official visit to was Alabama because of Nick Saban's reputation for developing number one first round draft choices out of that program. That's all Julian wanted, was to be developed by Nick. And he and Nick developed this bond, this coach-player relationship over time, where Julian made no other official visits to any other school. So his first day of classes, he's there at 3 o'clock. He has a 3 o'clock class. At 4 o'clock, he goes to his, and this is on a Wednesday. At 4 o'clock on Wednesday afternoon, he walks into a team meeting. By 4:05, Nick Saban has resigned as head football coach, retired as head football coach at Alabama. Julian's sitting there texting his mom going, oh my God, Coach Saban just retired. What in the world? And he was just heartbroken at that point in time. And then I won't get to it. There were a situation afterwards with the new coach that Julian felt he was in the wrong place. So he went into the portal and he's now at Ohio State. And I miss my guess here, he'll start for Ohio State, not this season, but next season. So is that tragic? No. Is it heartbreaking for the Saiyan family that actually moved to Tuscaloosa so they could be with their son during the course of his development? It's pretty heartbreaking. Trust me, his mom was in tears with me twice on the phone. So if you're kind of looking at the chaos in college football right now, that's a pretty good example of what's going on.
So just about a minute and a half or so. This is all sounding pretty negative in a lot of ways.
Bleak.
Yeah, bleak. But aside from the fact that at least the kids are getting the money, is there something positive that you see in the future for college football out of all this?
Well, I think college football has never been more popular than it is right now. I mean, what we see on the field, and Syracuse has a new head coach, a great recruiter out of Georgia, so there's optimism there in places like that, which is really great to see. On the field, the product has never been better. There's a 12-team playoff coming up, you know, in 2025. That's going to be incredible to watch. The difficulties are for the people that love the game is, you know, what's the future look like? There has to be some framework put into place, Grant, that beyond the players getting paid, has some idea where the coaches wake up every morning and have some structure that they know that they're dealing with. Right now, they don't. And I think that is really difficult right now to say where that solution is going to come from. But unless you lose the self-interest and the want and greed, and you work with Charlie Baker, the president of the NCAA now, I think that's the solution. It has to come from within. It's not going to come from the courts. It's not going to come from Congress. They have to think of the greater good. And until they do that, we're going to be witnessing what we're witnessing now.
It kind of reminds me in a way of the issue with money and campaigns.
Absolutely.
In terms of trying to put the genie back in the bottle, I don't think it's going to happen. But
well, as somebody said to me, when they say it's not about the money, it's about the money.
Well, we'll have to leave it there. That was Armen Katayan. And again, his new book is titled The Price: What It Takes to Win in College Football's Era of Chaos. And it's a splendid read. Mr. Katayan, thanks so much for taking the time to talk with me. And I have to say, personally, it's been a thrill to talk to you.
My pleasure. Thank you so much. I know a lot of those Syracuse grads, and they produce some pretty great talent out of there coming out of that school, I'll tell you that.
I appreciate you saying that. You've been listening to the Campbell Conversations on WRVO Public Media, conversations in the public interest.
The Campbell Conversations, Conversations in the Public Interest, is hosted and produced by Grant Reher, engineered by Tom Fazio. Assistant producer is Jacqueline Witwicky, and the program is edited by Mark Lefoner. The Campbell Conversations is a joint production of the Campbell Public Affairs Institute at Syracuse University and WRVO Public Media. To learn more about the program and hear previous interviews, visit wrvo.org/Campbell Conversations.